Welcome to Jurisdiction, the International Intellectual Property Law Podcast for April 2018. I'm your host, Don Cameron of Breskin & Parr, LLP in Toronto, Canada. We hope you'll find this podcast informative, but it should not be taken as legal advice. The opinions expressed are solely those of the participants. In late November 2017, Canada had its very first electronic intellectual property law trial. I was senior counsel and my colleague Jerry Chen was junior counsel. We were acting for the plaintiff, Georgetown Rail Equipment Company, against Tetra Tech in a patent infringement trial in the Federal Court of Canada before Justice Fothergill. The trial was virtually paperless with an all-electronic trial record. So this month's podcast is a little different. Jerry and I explain what happened and how we ran the trial electronically. Hi, Jerry.
Hi, Don.
So, Jerry, as I will explain in the intro to this podcast, this is a bit of a weird one because we're really talking amongst ourselves about the electronic trial that we had last November in the Georgetown matter, where you and I used an outside service provider in cooperation with the court to run Canada's first electronic patent trial. So let me give a bit of the background history to this. A year ago, May 2017, Chief Justice Crampton at the town hall meeting in Ottawa in connection with the Canadian Bar Association IP Day expressed an open invitation to the Canadian Intellectual Property Bar to take advantage of an electronic courtroom that was to be built in Toronto and hopefully be live and active in January 2018 to conduct electronic trials. And he invited counsel to volunteer to sign up for it. I had two cases that were headed to trial, one the end of November, our case, Jerry, and another one in January 2018. And in both cases, we explored with the opposing counsel the possibility of using electronic, replacing paper documents rather with electronic documents and running basically an all electronic trial. The court has had some experience with that already. Justice Mandelman of the federal court had a what I think was a multi-year hearing in the Alderville matter, and they used an outside service provider to do everything electronically. Also in the fall of 2017, Mr. Justice Zinn of the federal court in the Southwind matter used the same technology. It was another First Nations rights case, and I understand that that case was originally scheduled for about 100 days based on a conventional trial process, but before the trial, when it was switched to an electronic trial, it really required only about 50 days for the hearing. And I know in the closing statements of the judgment at paragraph 554, Mr. Justice Zinn at 2017 FC 906 said, and I quote, "Lastly, I express the appreciation of the court to the parties and their counsel. The trial was conducted using electronic documents. This saved the court and the parties much time and expense." So I think Justice Crampton thought that it was probably save at least 20 to 25% of the time in a case. And me being a longtime techno nerd was interested in that. So let's describe, if we can, maybe first the system that was used. It was a the same system that was used in the Alderville and the Southwind case. It's an outside, independent, cloud-hosted database, Canadian. The technology is hosted in Canada. It only provided access to the parties themselves and the court reporter, or whoever we let in to have access to the cloud service. And the whole thing was based or built on top of a commercial software called FileMaker Pro, which made it pretty easy to search for, find, and mark documents as exhibits. So, Jerry, it was about 3 or 4 weeks before the trial that we decided we were going to go ahead with this. So everything happened pretty quickly. You quarterback the uploading of our documents onto the cloud database. Can you describe sort of what process we went through to get our documents and the other side's documents up on this cloud service?
Sure. So before the trial, the parties agreed as to what documents would form the joint book of documents. So this joint book was the database of productions, and only some of those were marked as trial exhibits. So, and if parties needed to add certain documents later, one party would notify the other party and then have the provider uploaded to the server. This joint book, in our case, was accessible to the judge at all times, so the judge could see all of the documents in the joint book, but we were told that there was the option to sort of keep all of the documents hidden from the judge and only let the judge see what documents were marked as exhibits. So I think it will depend on the parties and the judge as to which method they prefer.
So I know normally, at least on a traditional computer or on a file server, documents are kept in files. This was more of a database or document management system that we were using. So what did we do in terms of creating analogs to folders for documents, say our files and their files?
So what you would see in the software is our documents loaded as a list. There's no traditional folder structure that you would find, for example, in Windows, but instead you can tag documents using a variety of issues. Issues such as, for example, documents for cross-examination of witness A. Then when you search by the issues, only the tagged documents show up. So this is like folders, but better, because a document can appear in multiple folders, but there's still only one version of the document on the server. And also, because the parties might tag the documents differently, the folder structure will be different for both parties.
And that folder structure or the tagging would only be visible to the party who did the tagging, right?
Yes, that's correct.
So although our trial was in December 2017, and the courtroom wasn't built or would not be built until early in 2018, we did understand, I think, from discussions with the court that they still had some of the monitors and the computer system that was used in the Southwind case available in Toronto. And we asked whether or not we'd be able to use that, and the answer was yes. So we weren't using the electronic courtroom that the federal court is building, but really just use the same system that Justice Zinn and I understand Justice Mandelman had used. So let's describe the courtroom. Why don't you describe the courtroom?
So in this courtroom, everybody had a monitor. There were monitors at the front counsel table for both parties. I believe these were sort of the main screens that were connected directly to the counsel's laptop and which sort of drove the rest of the screens.
So we had two screens on our front counsel table, right?
Yes. So we had the one screen that was that would be broadcast to the rest of the screens, and then we also had a secondary screen where I was able to sort of manipulate documents, and that was really just private to you and I.
So that was like a staging area where you could call up the documents we wanted and then drag them over to the screen that would be broadcast to the rest of the courtroom.
That's correct. It provided extra screen real estate, so I didn't have to rely only on the screen on my laptop.
Yeah. And we had our clients behind us. They had a screen that they shared. It was interesting to note that the judge had a screen, and as hierarchies appropriately would have, he seemed to have the biggest one in the courtroom.
I believe it was 32 inches.
That
was what I was told.
The witness box had a screen for the witness. The registrar, who is really in charge of the system, had a screen in front of her, and the court reporter had one as well. The law clerk for the judge was also in the courtroom. I can't recall whether or not she had a screen. She was sitting in the other witness box. Do you recall whether she had one too or not?
My recollection is that I think she did, and she also had her own laptop as well.
Right. And last but not least, the podium between the counsel table in the middle of the courtroom had a screen as well. And that screen was just off to the left of the podium where otherwise you'd have your notes on it. So you could look down at that screen to see what was on the common courtroom screen. Many of the screens were in what I'd call portrait mode, where the screen was vertical, because that suited the shape of a typical document, 8.5 by 11 document. But as far as the as far as the control of the courtroom, am I correct that the registrar really decided which counsel had control of what was going on the communal screens?
Yes, I believe it was just a flip switch, so you could switch from the plaintiff's counsel to the defendant's counsel.
Yeah. So why don't we talk a little bit about our case? It was originally scheduled to last for 10 days. We were assuming, I think, 8 days of evidence and 1 or 2 days of argument, so 2 5-day weeks. We ended up spending only 6 days of evidence and 1 day of argument. I think part of that was driven by the fact that the issues themselves became more simplified as we approached the trial. But I think we probably also saved about a day in evidence as a result of the electronic documents, just because we could get them up in front of the witness faster. I might digress for a moment to say it was not a completely paperless trial, because we did carry to the courtroom paper copies of the expert reports, which were, I won't say voluminous, but they were several of them. They reach an inch or two thick, with exhibits. But I think we had them there because it was much easier for the witness to flip back and forth in their reports to access documents and compare things on different pages. And we also had it there as a backup. So let's talk a little bit about the logistics of getting the system set up. We bought 3 licenses for FileMaker Pro for our office, one for you, I think, one for me, and one for our law clerk. Likewise, the opposing firm did so. And then we bought 3 licenses for the court to use, one for the judge, one for the registrar, and one for the judge's law clerk. We then had to pay a bit of money for training for the system and for the use of the system, but I think the cost of the system overall for running it through trial was about $5,000 per party. And on the back of an envelope, we calculated that to add up to about 6.5 boxes of photocopying. And I think we knew early on that we would probably run costs in excess of that for photocopying pretty quickly, given the fact that when you go to trial, you usually need 10 copies of everything, some for your side, some for the other side, some for the witness, 3 for the court, etc. So I think we probably saved money, and we certainly saved a lot of schlepping of boxes by going electronic. So let's talk about at trial and how we manage things. Jerry, sometimes we had some additional documents that we wanted to add at the end of the day. We had the witnesses sometimes draw on a big whiteboard, and I mean literally a flip chart paper version with felt pens, old-fashioned style. And what we did with that is took photos of the drawing and then designated that to be the trial exhibit. So could you explain how that got added into the cloud database?
Sure. So at the end of each day, whatever new documents that we wanted added to the database, we would simply send a copy to the registrar and also copy opposing counsel, so everybody's on the same page and everybody knows what's being uploaded to the server.
And one of the beauties of the system was, in terms of marking trial exhibits, could you describe what that process was and how we marked electronic documents as trial exhibits?
Sure. So the registrar kept track of the exhibits almost completely electronically, and this was something that we found to be very helpful. If a document was already on the server at the time that we wanted it marked, we basically called out the document ID to be marked, and the registrar just did it on the spot. If the document wasn't already on the server, we would send it to the registrar at the end of the day, and then she would then upload it to the server and then mark it as an exhibit.
Yeah, so the software that we used actually had literally a button that I think she could press, and it automatically then gave it either a P number if it was a plaintiff trial exhibit or a D number if it was a defendant's exhibit. And this was added on to the joint document number, so it could be the database could be sorted and you could create a list or call up a document either by its old joint document number or by its trial exhibit number. And by making it so she just had to press a button to do it, it was like it was instantly stamped that way for future reference. So in cross-examination, we could have, I think, have put documents up on the system, but we decided to, I guess, for the slightly the element of surprise, I organized our cross-examinations by either putting copies of documents or images from documents that were already on the system in a PowerPoint presentation as my sort of cross-examination booklet for the witness. So we put that up on the screen. Can you explain maybe a little bit more about how we ran that process?
Sure. So when it comes to things like cross-examination, there's always a concern that perhaps you don't want to show the other side what documents you intend to rely on. So one way you can do it is that you don't need to upload the documents until just right before you present it, or you can provide separate electronic copies or paper copies. And as long as you show it on all of the screens, you can upload the document later for marking. We did this for various PowerPoint presentations that you did during the direct and as well as cross-examinations.
We also had at the trial daily transcripts, and they were uploaded either at the end of the day or the beginning of the next day. But maybe let's describe the process we used for the final argument. I was going to call it the final written argument. I guess it was written, but electronically. We did, I guess, over the weekend before we did the written argument, downloaded the entire trial record. So for the final argument, we wanted to make use of the fact that we had the entire trial record in electronic form. So what we did when we created our final argument, we created as a Word document on the same directory as a downloaded version of all of the trial exhibits and the trial transcripts. And what that allowed us to do was provide hyperlinks from our written argument. We typically footnoted where in the trial record the evidence was given and by who. And we could then hyperlink those footnotes directly to the page of the transcript or the page of the trial exhibit. So it was as if the judge was on a hyperlink web page and he could click to that and get exactly to the page that we were directed. So we didn't create a compendium of documents as such. And when we handed up our written argument and provided a written copy to the court, we also provided a thumb drive that had the written argument hyperlinked to the trial transcripts and trial exhibits. Jerry, let me kind of step back and say we didn't use all of the functionality that this cloud system had, given the fact that we only had a few weeks before trial and we also had to get ready for the trial. Can you discuss a couple of the other abilities that the system had that we didn't make use of?
Sure. One of the functions that we were told that a witness could do was they could mark up a document using an iPad. That's something that we didn't end up doing. But when it comes to what the counsel can do, we can use whatever program we normally use to manipulate PDFs. And at the end of the day, you can either discard the marked up version of the document, or you can upload the marked up version as a separate joint book document, or even just mark it as an exhibit.
Yeah, so I think just as the computer monitors could otherwise be used, an iPad had additional functionality. You could hand it to the witness and have them circle things or mark it up or so forth, and then you could save that marked up version as a new exhibit. The other functionality I think we didn't use was the ability to make notes on a document. Is that right?
Yes, I believe that's correct. I may have made some private notes initially, but I think at the end of the day, that wasn't a highly utilized function of the software.
And I think, as I recall, these notes were more like an annotation or in a document management system where you could provide some keywords to a document. It didn't allow you to physically mark up the individual document like a annotator would, but allowed you to effectively put a post-it note on the entire document that had some notes that might be of interest to you. And those notes would be private only to you.
Yes, that's correct. The documents that the parties see would be the original version of the document along with any sort of private notes that they've marked up. The other parties wouldn't be able to see the private notes of the other parties or the judge.
So in terms of the net result of this case, we did take some boxes to court. We did have a breakout room where we had our breaks between during the trial and at lunchtime. And we have to confess, though, that the boxes we carried up usually contained either A, water, or B, cookies, right?
Yeah, I think there was a lot more cookies being carried back and forth than paper in this case.
Jerry, there was one other advantage in that we didn't need to exchange USB drives with opposing counsel. Can you explain, based on your experience having done that in other cases, what advantages this system had over the old-fashioned way?
Yes, we thought not having to deal with USB drives was a significant advantage because everything simply got uploaded to the server, and we didn't have to deal with physical USB drives, which themselves may have there may be confidentiality issues associated with it. And there was a lot less organization that we needed to do.
There was one feature that we've discussed that it's either a benefit or a bug of the system, and that was our inability to directly upload and manage the documents on the system. And I say it might have been an advantage from a security or quality control point of view. If somebody else was uploading it, we couldn't mess that up. But from a disadvantage point of view, it did slow the ability down, I guess, to a day or later that day in order to have a document put up. Do you want to comment on that briefly?
I think the ability to allow a party to modify or upload a document is there because the court registrar was given that ability. But I think the service provider decided that it was probably better in most cases, to not let the parties themselves sort of manipulate the documents. And I think that may be a good thing. But like you said, there are disadvantages in that it sort of takes longer and we're limited to the availability of the third party. Yep. So it's sort of a balance at the end of the day.
Okay. So the court is still expressing interest in having people use systems like this. This is really, I think, both the both our case and the two First Nations rights cases, Southwind and Alderville, have been experiments by the court, and the system we were using is not necessarily what the court's going to be using once it gets up and running and perhaps has funding to develop its own system. But the court is still inviting people to take advantage of this and encouraging it. It did seem to the court seemed to like it, and counsels, at least we certainly did, in order to making the thing better. This new electronic courtroom is being built in Toronto. It will be fully wired and ready to go. So it'll be interesting to see how quickly the bar, I think the intellectual property bar, might adapt and adopt faster than the non-IP bar, simply because of our, a lot of us anyway, have a technical background, a bit of a technical bent, so we might be more willing to adapt to the new electronic world. But it'll be interesting to see where this goes. And speaking of where this goes, Jerry, since our trial last fall, you and I have parted company. You've started up your own firm here in Toronto. I wonder if you want to explain a little bit about what you're up to these days and where you see yourself headed in the future.
So I've recently launched my own firm, JZC Intellectual Property Law. And what we offer is a range of IP litigation and advisory services, as well as assistance with licensing and other contractual issues. So on the litigation side, we can also provide support to larger firms on an as-needed basis if they need additional manpower on a specific matter or if they need someone who speaks Chinese and Japanese, which I do. And anyways, you can just go to my website, jerrychen.ca, for more information. It's Jerry with a J.
Okay. Well, thanks very much, Jerry, and I appreciate this.
Thank you very much, Don.
Jerry Chen is an IP lawyer at JZC Intellectual Property Law in Toronto, Canada. For further information on other jurisdiction podcasts, please visit iplawpodcast.com. You have been listening to Jurisdiction, the International Intellectual Property Law Podcast. I'm Don Cameron of Breskin & Parr, LLP in Toronto, Canada. Thank you for listening.